Welcome to episode 459 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. My name is Michael Eriksson, and today I interview Matt Silver. Matt is a physical therapist, runner, and author of the book Built to Run. And in this interview, he peels back the layers of the underlying causes of typical running injuries and discusses how to prevent and overcome issues and injuries by identifying and tackling the root causes behind them. Before we get into the interview with Matt, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They create carbohydrate products like gels, drink mix, and chews that are effective, practical, and tasty. And of course, they also make electrolyte products in different strengths, so you can choose one that best matches your sweat sodium concentration. Their products make it easy for you to execute your nutrition and hydration plan in both training and racing, as they are tasty, have practical packaging, and use simple round numbers, so you don't have to do mental math when you're redlining in a race. They have a free fuel and hydration planner, free consultations with sports scientists, and a massive database of case studies with lots of in-depth and well-researched articles as well that will give you everything from the basics to the finer nuances on nutrition and hydration. And as a TTS listener, you can get 15% off your first order of 2025 by using the code TTS25 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Now, without any further ado, let's go into the interview with Matt Silver. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Matt. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good as well. Excited for this chat. And let's not waste any more time. Let's just dive straight into things. But we start with an introduction of yourself. Can you tell us more about who you are and your background in running and in physical therapy?
Yeah. I'm a physical therapist in Maryland, right, in the United States in Maryland. And background in treating distance runners. More than just distance runners, I do see a good handful of triathletes and, you know, CrossFit athletes and just really people that are very active. But my bread and butter, how I started my practice 5-6 years ago was only treating runners. And there's just a lot of things that can go wrong. And I take myself as an example, where I grew up running track and field and cross country. And all of a sudden, I got to my sophomore year of college, and I'm like, man, my back is killing me. I have a lot of knee issues, and I had to give up running. So that was a lot of motivation to kind of become a physical therapist, get into distance or treat distance runners. That's kind of my background is. I've been through it. I've been injured. I think I've had every injury under the sun as a runner. So that's really motivated me and kind of helped cultivate who I am today of, yes, a physical therapist, but really with a specialty in treating runners and triathletes and people that want to be active and just, hey, I want to be able to lift weights and run and swim and bike and not be in pain and be able to push myself and be active.
So at that time in college, when you had to quit running, were you already studying physical therapy then? Was that what you were already into, or did that come about later?
Yeah, I was. My undergrad degree is in exercise science and sports studies. It's just a general, like, hey, if you're interested in fitness, this is a degree you can get. I used that. I kind of knew I wanted to be a physical therapist. So to me, it was a natural stepping stone. But I wasn't in physical therapy. I wasn't in grad school yet to get my doctorate. I was still an undergrad when that happened. And I was actually actively, they make you do a lot of shadowing hours they want to make sure, hey, this is what you want to do. They don't want you to get the PT school and then change your mind. So I did been doing a lot of shadowing, and I kind of saw what physical therapy was, and I was like, man, I this is something I definitely want to do. I want to help people get, you know, just be able to move better and not move in pain and be able to do the things they want to do. But for me, I actually noticed some of the physical therapy in the States, there can be issues with it where insurance tends to dictate some treatment. And I had multiple experiences where some were fantastic, where I'm like, man, this is kind of the setting I want to work in. And other times I noticed that, man, physical therapy sometimes is, it's more this generic, get you on the bike, let's put a heat pack on it, and let's do these basic exercises versus, what we do now. What I love doing is, hey, let's look at your running form. Like, let's load you. Let's get you stronger. What's your mobility like? Things that I know will help runners and triathletes and people not be in pain versus this general stuff. So I had a kind of a mixed bag of, I'd been to PT before, it didn't work. And it's interesting. I still wanted to be a PT because I think I wanted to really specialize in treating active people and especially runners. So I had this kind of mixed bag of experiences of, on one hand, I saw PT that didn't really work too well. But on the other hand, I'm like, especially in my case, because I went to PT, it didn't work. But then on the other hand, I'm like, I know this can work.
Yeah, I think that's something that is probably a global phenomenon, that there are some physical therapists that are amazing and work wonders, and there are some that are maybe not so much and are very generic, let's say. And I think that that in many ways is very similar to coaching as well. But that's certainly my experience. I've also had some injuries personally that I've gone to physical therapy for. And it's been a mixed bag, but sometimes it's amazing. I definitely think that, that's something that everybody who has been injured and has had to maybe had to learn the hard way, how to find somebody that is good and not just somebody that is good, but also somebody, because sometimes you maybe don't have the exact right personal connection with an athlete as a physical therapist or vice versa as an athlete, as a physical therapist with an athlete or vice versa. So anyway, before we dive into some of the topics that we're going to get to, more of the factual topics, let's say, a little bit more on your story, because I think so many people do suffer from injuries that I think it was clear from your book that I haven't read in full yet, but I have kind of browsed through it. And it seems like you managed to overcome your running injuries and figure out what you needed to do to stay injury-free. So can you talk a bit more about that, as that can be, I think, quite informational, but also inspirational for people that are struggling with injuries?
Yeah. No, it's a loaded question and a story, but let's dive into it. So I think I'm going back to college. I think I had to stop running after my sophomore year. And that was a rough time. That was like, I was like extremely lean at the time. I think we just finished, like, I ran Division III cross country. So I think we went to regionals and like, I had a horrible race. Like, my knees flared up, back was killing me. And actually I took off probably my sophomore year of college. And one more year, I did my undergrad in 3 years, which was an insane amount of work. But I had one more year of undergrad and 3 years of grad school. So I think that was like 4 years of not a lot of running. And then I think 1 year as a physical therapist, that's when I started getting back into it. So I had like 4 years of no running, because every time I try to run, Michael, my knees would kill me. I'm like, I can't run more than 2 miles because of this. And that's, I've heard of other runners, you know, they kind of through high school, they're phenomenal runners. They're running 15, 16 minute 5Ks, and they get to college and they just get burnt out and they can't run anymore. So this is a specific and unique to me. I've heard other runners go through a very similar just kind of issue with the running career. So for me, a big thing was I got into mobility. I started following a physical therapist by the name of Kelly Storet. I don't know if you've heard of him, but I've learned a lot of mobility drills and just exercises to do from him. And so I started doing like mobility for essentially quad mobility and ankle mobility. These are things that started the process of, once I started working on mobility, Michael, I'm like, man, now I can actually run. Doesn't feel perfect, but it was able to take that kind of the pain, a lot of the pain away, where I was able to get back to like running 4, 5, 6 miles. And once I pushed it past there, I think I knew I had still had issues, but mobility tends to be a quicker fix. But that I'm glad I started there, because that helped a ton. Was let me just improve my mobility. And then, which was kind of like a lot of stretching, a good amount of lacrosse ball work, which is just soft tissue work. I just had a lot of tight tissues and a lot of stiffness, which is like muscle knots or fascia that can get all jumbled up, and just, it's just hard. It just limits your ability to move and muscles to contract. That was a big thing. I then kind of dove into running form, which at the time my running form was pretty bad. It was not good at all. So I went from mobility, that helped a lot. And that actually helped my running form, I think, a little bit, because we could talk about later, Michael, how, you know, tight hip flexors can limit the amount of hip extension, which is a leg behind you motion. But I then really started to improve my running form, which instead of slamming my foot out in front of me, I was landing closer to my center of mass. It's impossible to land directly under your body. It's just not going to happen. But landing closer to your center of mass, that helped a ton, really focusing on my push-off position. And then the third thing I did was then, which is probably the hardest for me, because I'm just, I'd much rather run than go strength train, but it's a little bit different now, where I see the benefit of it now. But I do a good amount of lifting now, of whether it's, you know, barbell deadlifting, barbell squatting, you know, a Bulgarian split squat. Calf raises are huge for runners, having a strong calf. Like, people think that running makes you stronger. It really doesn't. It makes you a more efficient runner. Like, swimming makes you better at swimming. Biking, I've seen a lot of bikers that have massive quads. Maybe biking gives you really strong quads. That might be the exception. But for the most part, cardio makes you better at that specific cardio. Like, if all you do is bike, it might make you okay at running. It's not going to make you it's not going to make you the best runner you can be. So you have to run. But if all you do is run, it's not going to make you stronger. So for me, I had to do some strength training. And in the beginning, it sucks because I'm not used to it. But time over time, it just, you know, the goal is for most runners, we don't want to be super bulky. Problem is, it's very hard to do that. It's a lot of determination and a lot of work to actually build muscle mass. But we just want to be strong enough to handle the loads of that running puts on us, which is easily 200 to 250% your body weight every step you take. So it's more than two times your body weight of force every step you take on one leg. So we have to do some strength training. And that was kind of the keystone that I think helped me a lot, Michael, is the first two things, the quicker fixes were the mobility and the running form. But then the hardest, but what I got the most benefit from, I think, was definitely the strength training, because I didn't really do much of that. And that helped a ton with just running to feel easier and efficient.
Yeah, and we'll dive into all of those three topics in detail. Actually, incidentally, they are next on the list. So let's just get into that from a more general sense. But for sure, you can use your own case study as well if you want to exemplify. But let's start with running form, perhaps, and if you can just discuss how that is connected to injuries. And we'll start from there, and then we'll come into some follow-up questions.
Yeah, running form. Running form is a good one, because it's this thing that I feel like a lot of runners, we just don't focus on it. Like when I was in high school, it was just go run, right? Like go run, do your thing. And there was no emphasis on mobility or strength. It was just go run, do your thing, and then you finish the workout and you're done. I think of running form as like, it's almost like when you throw a baseball or you're squatting. Like there's a good squat form, like a general squat form. And also there's a way to throw a ball, right? Elbow up. If you keep the elbow low, like any baseball coach or any coach you have should say, hey, get the elbow up, because if you keep the elbow low, you're probably going to have an increased risk of causing an elbow or a shoulder issue. So if we know this is a thing for, like, there's a way to skate, there's a way to take a slap shot in hockey, there's ways to do things. And if you could optimize that, you're probably going to perform better, B, you decrease your risk of injury. So from a running standpoint, distance running is all about efficiency. Like we have, the muscles are being used, but actually a lot of times it's actually our fascia system that's being used, where yes, our muscles are contracting, but we get a lot of muscles and the fascia and tissues get stretched out and they reflexively contract out of that. So if we are putting ourselves in positions where we can't take advantage of that, we're working too hard to move forwards. Like running is all about efficiency. If you can optimize that, you're going to use less energy than the runner to your left and the runner to your right. And A, it's going to have decreased risk of injury. B, it's going to help you run faster. And one of the biggest issues I see tends to be this: you're landing too far out in front of your body. Where think of this as like you're putting the brakes on every step you take. So if I'm a little running man here, I'm running and I'm landing way out here instead of here, or even like I can't land directly here, but if I'm landing here or here versus way out here, it's just you're going to put the brakes on a little bit, and our body needs that. We respond to that. But if you're landing way out front, you're kicking that leg out, you got this massive heel strike, you're just slowing yourself down every step you take, and you then have to reaccelerate every time. So it's just, you're just fighting yourself the whole time. So running form, that's probably the biggest thing we see is overstriding. But it's like running and you're just putting the brakes on. It's like every time you're driving, you're just like, it's like you're trying to drive your car with the e-brake on. It's like, well, you're slowing your,
yeah, the handbrake.
Yeah. Yeah. The handbrake. You're trying to slow yourself down the whole time. Yeah. Like, yeah, put the hand, I've done, you know, sometimes you park on a hill, you put the handbrake on, you forget it's there, and you're trying to drive. Like, why is the car doing this? Why does it feel like this? Oh, I forgot to change the handbrake. That's what it's like running while overstriding. Is you just got the brakes on the whole time. Let's change that. Let's just teach you to land a little bit closer to your center of mass, and you'd be amazed how much more efficient we can be when running.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. And you'll know this better than me, but I'm pretty sure that I've seen research that is directly correlating, at least, yeah, harder to prove any causality, but between overstriding and knee injuries, like runner's knee and so on. So, in your case, with the knee injuries that you had, that also kind of makes the story come together quite nicely, I guess.
Oh yeah, yeah. Me overstriding did not help things, and that's the thing. Like I remember in college, I was, you know, I'm putting 60-mile weeks. And that's a lot of volume. And imagine if I could have optimized that volume, I would have had much less pain. I just would have got more out of my workouts. And this just tends to be the issue with running, is you're doing the same thing over and over again. And if we're inefficient somewhere, something's working too hard, it tends to rear its head eventually, especially as you start to increase in mileage, where if you're just running 5 miles a week, you can get away with that, especially as, you know, as a triathlete. Like, there's a lot of volume that you're going to be putting in. It's more than just running, right? You're swimming. There's shoulder mobility needed with that. There's specific things with the bike that we could talk about. But if we're putting in volume, we have to make sure we're moving the right way. And if you have a shoulder mobility issue, you can't get your, you know, you can't get your shoulder here, you're stuck here. Well, that's really going to, that's going to affect how your shoulder's moving when you're trying to do the front crawl and as you're swimming, you're, you know, whether it's a half mile, full mile, whatever it is. So we have to work on shoulder mobility. That's from a swimming example. That's part of it, but swimming form matters, and running form. Running is a repeated single leg hop over and over again. It's a plyometric exercise. It's high intensity. And that's why we tend to get injured more when things are off when running is you're jumping over and over and over again. Or no wonder why injury rates are around, what, like 40, 50%. I see studies go from 20 to 80%. I'm like, well, let's meet in the middle. It's probably around 50% of runners or get some level of injury in a year. This is probably why, Michael, it's such a high intensity, high force, and also high volume activity. This is why we tend to see a lot of issues with runners, especially if things are just not moving the way they should.
Yeah, even among triathletes, for non-traumatic injuries in triathletes, I think it's about 70%, maybe even 80% of injuries that are running related rather than swimming and cycling. Yeah. Of course, when you add traumatic injuries, you have cycling starts to come into play there as well. But yeah, running definitely takes a large chunk of those overused non-traumatic injuries. Other than not overstriding, are there any other big blocks of running form that you think are really important?
Yeah, overstriding is probably the biggest one. I would say there's other ones too. We call it like a collapser, where like if your hip drops too much, your knee caves in too much. That's definitely an important one. One that's not in the book, one that's not in Built to Run is, well, technically it is. It's called a glute amnesiac, but there's the one of them is where essentially like you don't get as much of a push off position on the back end. So think of like a lot of times if our hips are tight, we'll actually overstride it to compensate for, like, instead of getting a nice push off, like you know, that push off position where you're pushing yourself, you're propel yourself forwards. Instead of if your hips are tight, you can't get that push off position, or you just don't know how to do it. Sometimes we got to train people. Just your hips aren't tight. We just got to teach you to push behind yourself. We'll end up overstriding. So we can't get the leg behind us. We'll compensate by landing farther out in front of our body. Think of this, Michael, as like if you've ever shot a slingshot. Say that 10 times fast. If you've ever shot a slingshot or a bow and arrow. You know, when I shoot my bow and arrow back, my compound bow, right? I do a full draw, I anchor it to my cheek and my nose, and then I release. Well, imagine if you only drew it halfway back, it would have nowhere near the same amount of force, but B, it'd also be very inaccurate. So it's an inefficient way to run, where if we could teach people to really get that leg behind them, you store a lot of energy and then you can release that energy. So that's a big, it's a part of other running issues, but that's a huge piece of running form is we have to make sure we're getting the leg behind us to essentially that allows us to use our muscles the right way, but it allows us to get this really efficient, when we push off, there's a stretch of the tissues in the front of our leg and they reflexively bring our leg forward. So if you can optimize that leg position in the back, you're just slingshotting yourself forwards, which is, again, makes running so much easier if we can just use our body the way it was meant to be used.
Okay, so a two-part follow-up on generally all of these things, all of the running form related things that you mentioned. First of all, how do you identify where you might have a limitation? And secondly, if you have identified a limitation, then how do you actually go about improving it?
Yeah, that's a good question. There can be some like mobility. It's tough to answer that. Well, I guess it's a two-part answer to that. You could look at like different things can cause different running form issues. So if we do some mobility tests with you, Michael, and like there, and you know, there's the couch stretch. It's like COUCH, the couch stretch. Where if you can pass that test, we know you have hip mobility. But if we get you on the running form and if we do a running form assessment and we look at you and say, hey, you're not getting your leg behind you, you're overstriding, your hips dropping, it tells me what's going on. But it's not going to tell me why it's happening, right? So you might not get that leg behind you because the hips are tight. We have to teach you how to do it. So a running form assessment is probably the easiest way to just get an idea of what does it look like? What are you doing wrong? What could we work on? That's the easiest way to start. But then the harder part is, well, why aren't you getting your leg behind you, right? Like, why are we not getting this good push off position? It could be hip tightness, could just be it could just be you just don't know how to do it, and we have to cue you to get the leg behind you. So there's different solutions to the problem. We just have to know like why it looks. Hopefully that answered the question. But typically, at your running form, and then depending on what we find, let's dive a little bit deeper.
Let's say we have somebody who has passed all of the mobility tests and also strength when that is connected. If they have something like you identify that you don't get your leg behind you, or it could be that they're overstriding. What is then a protocol for actually working on your running form to get over that issue?
Yeah, that's the fun part. This is where if we know it's not mobility, sometimes it could be a strength issue. A lot of times it's just we have to teach your brain to move the way we want it to move. So it's like I have almost 12 weeks old now, my son Luke. He hasn't rolled over yet. He has better head control now, but eventually he's going to start walking. I don't know, but that's like 7 months or 8 months, but he's just going to learn how to do the movement. He's going to fall down a bunch. He's going to grab on the furniture. We're going to help him, but he's going to fall down a lot. But over time, his brain's going to learn. Of course, he's going to get stronger too, but he's going to learn how to do the movement. When we're overstriding and everything looks good on paper, your strength is good, your mobility is fantastic. Let's say you aren't getting the leg behind you, right? You got a good push-off position, but you're still overstriding. How do we fix this? This is where drills and cues can come into play, where I'll teach people, we'll go over the marching drills, which essentially, before you run, you can do these drills where you march in place, and you pull the heel under your glutes, and you land underneath your body. And we teach that. We can start moving forwards. But also we can, not only can we give drills like, hey, practice this maybe 2-3 minutes before you run, and then you can go into the marching drill, go right into your run. That tends to work well. But also we can do cues, which is you're on the treadmill, you're running outside. And sometimes we'll even do this. If someone comes in for a running form assessment or even virtually, I'll say, hey, let's see if this works. And sometimes cues work better and sometimes they don't work at all. We got to kind of play around with them. But if someone's running, the cue I love to use is, hey, imagine that you're running on ice. Right, you're in an ice rink. Don't slip on the ice. Just go. Imagine there's ice everywhere. Keep it very simple. The goal is not to I'm freaking out. There's ice. No. Don't freak out. It's very relaxed. Just think about this when you run. You can think about it for a minute and then take a break. Think about it 10 minutes later. But if you imagine you're running on ice, you might not want to take that big old step out in front, because if you do, you're here. You're going to slip and fall. So we can use verbal cues along with some drills and some motor control exercises to start to rewire the brain of, hey, instead of doing this, let's change this. And it can be very hard. People have ran certain ways for 5, 10, 15, 20 years at changing a motor control pattern. Doable, but sometimes it's challenging. It's a lot easier, though, when the hardware, when the mobility and the and all that stuff is good. It's a little easier to change the software of the let's give you some cues and see if we can change a few things.
Yeah, that cue, imagine you're running on ice, being from Finland, I would know exactly what to do if you gave me that cue, I can tell you. all right, but I think that's actually one more question about running form. Are there any common misconceptions about running form that you think people have?
Oh, that's a good one. I think the most common one is people think that you don't have to change it. I guess I'll preface that. Some people have great running form, and I get them on a treadmill. I'm like, you're great. You're crushing it. We fixed a few little teeny tiny things here and there, but they're crushing it. A lot of people, I would say the majority, but a lot of people we have to work on a few things to improve our efficiency. So I think if there's a misconception, the misconception is, hey, I don't have to work on my running form. The misconception is you run the way you feel like the best way to run is. And sometimes that actually works. I'm not opposed to that. If you can run and it's efficient, I get you in here and you're like, you're great, especially if you don't have injuries, that you're crushing it. But I think a lot of runners, especially new runners, it's challenging to adopt the very efficient running form pattern. And part of I think this has to be because of the things we were putting on our feet. We have these big cushiony shoes. It just promotes us. It's almost like to clear the foot from the ground, we have to kick the leg out farther. We see it when walking too. A lot of people overstride when they walk because we got these big old heel lifts on. And these massive cushion shoes. Not hating on Hoka or hating on Asics or anything, but it's an uphill battle to run the right way when we have these cushion shoes where they're just promoting us to overstride. So it's definitely possible for you to be able to run and not overstride and be very efficient. It's very challenging in today's society where we sit a lot. We have tight hips and we have these big cushion shoes and we're used to just, even when walking, we're used to kicking that leg way out far in front and smacking the heel down. And heel striking's normal when we're walking. That's supposed to heel. We're supposed to heel strike, but it's, we could probably, I just know a lot of people are overstriding. So that's probably the biggest misconception is that your running form is, we never have to work on it, where we can definitely work on it. And a lot of people benefit from it just from just the society we live in, where we got these big old cushion shoes we're wearing and just with everything going on with society, we sit down a lot. That tends to be the issue that I find.
Yeah. Then let's move on to talk about mobility. So again, if you can give us an overview of mobility and how that might be related to running injuries and also performance in general.
Yeah. Yeah. Mobility, it tends to be a catch-all term. And I think some people get confused by, like, what does it actually mean? Mobility is the ability to fluidly move through a range of motion without restrictions, and also have really an efficient muscle contraction as well. So a good example is you could actually have, let's say if I face sideways here, you could have full shoulder flexion. Like I can get this up here. I get a full range of motion per se. That's just a part of mobility, but are the right muscles actually contracting, right? I can get this up here and actually be like, oh, I get a lot of pinching because I could have shoulder impingement and still get my shoulder. I still have full range of motion, right? We have to make sure that the muscle, like your serratus anterior, your trapezius, your upper trap, your rotator cuff, all these muscles, there's no stiffness. The muscles aren't shortened. There's so many conversations we can see, Michael, where you have a stiff tissue or something's weak or something's tight, where it might look like you've got great range of motion, but on the back end, I have pain, it just doesn't feel very good. So the same thing with hip extension. You can look like you have hip extension, getting a leg behind you, but many times it's actually the pelvis will kind of do this weird kind of rotation where you kind of dump the pelvis, like kind of like you have a duck butt, like you're sticking your butt out behind you. There's so many conversations we can have that it looks good, but if the hip flexors are tight and they're stiff and it's all gummed up and there's muscle knots and the fascia's all stiff in there, well, that can limit your hip extension. It's going to limit muscle's ability to contract. So there's kind of these different buckets of there's tissue stiffness, there's tightness, there's also like the joint capsule, which is the hip joint itself. Like someone has arthritis, that capsule gets stiff and that might limit mobility, and we could do the best we can to get some of that back. But there's different buckets of mobility, but it's our goal is to make sure, especially as a runner or as a triathlete, let's make sure we have as much mobility as possible to keep us moving as optimally as we can. So hopefully that, I know that was a big mouthful, but hopefully that made sense.
Yeah, yeah. And in your experience then, because you mentioned hip flexors a lot, mm-hmm. is that an area where you mostly see that people are limited mobility-wise these days?
Yes, there's, I think the big three are probably the hips, like getting the leg behind you because you sit so much. I'd say hip extension, which because the hip flexors are so tight, they limit that opposite motion. Ankle mobility is actually a big one. And not the way for swimming, but where you call it plantar flexion. It's not where you're pointing your foot. It's the opposite way. Like if you're going to do a deep squat, keep the heel down. And can you drive that knee over the toe? You'd be surprised, Michael. Like you need upwards of 30 degrees of that when you're running, even more if you're running fast. So like you need a lot of knee over toe motion when you're running, and it's essentially when we get the mid stance where our foot is underneath our body and we start to push off a little bit more, you need a lot of that knee over toe motion. So there's a lot of hip extension that we need, ankle mobility that we need for running. And it's called the Z angle. Like, can you get hip extension? Cause it's like it's hip extension and then the ankle, like you want to maximize that Z angle as much as you can. And then the shoulder's another, a big one as well, where there's the shoulder's so mobile. There's just a lot that can go wrong with the shoulder joint could be tight. The muscles there could be stiff. Typically, it's either stiffness or like the joint capsule's tight. We tend not to see as much. Sometimes the lat can actually be tight itself, or the muscle can be shortened. But we tend to see more like muscle knots and kind of like some fascial knots, or fascial issues like in the trapezius area. But the shoulder, if anything, like from the swimming standpoint, the shoulder hands down tends to be another big one. But from a running standpoint, it's hip extension and it's ankle mobility.
Yeah. And what you mentioned, the couch stretch as a test for the hip mobility, is that what you would generally recommend? And is there another test that you can do for your ankle mobility to see, identify whether you are you have reduced mobility there?
Yes, yeah, hands down, the couch stretch is a great way to know kind of where you're at hip extension wise. Ankle mobility, I tend to use, I just call it the box test or the wall test. You just take your hand. So pinky to thumb, which is just about like 4 inches, maybe 5 if you got a bigger hand. But essentially, you place that, you know, like sideways, you know, just kind of flush against the wall. And then you take your foot and you put your big toe against your thumb. You can take your hand away and then drive that knee towards the wall. You want to be able to, whether that's 4 or 5 inches, whatever it is, you want to be able to have your knee touch the wall without your heel popping off. So you're kind of doing like a lunge into the wall. So that's a great way to just test, do you have the range of motion? And then second thing is, where do you actually feel it? And this is what I'll do with any client or patient, who comes and sees me. It's like, you know, we're looking for, do you have the mobility, the range of motion generally, but also if the heel starts to pop off, or if you can't do the couch stretch, like if you can't get up all the way, well, what do you feel that's tight? For the couch stretch, it's typically the quads and the hip flexor. But for the ankle, a lot of times it might not even be the calf muscle. It might be the ankle itself. And you get this like pinching in the front of the ankle that tends to be the joint capsule. And, you know, we do hands-on techniques to help improve that, but it's just as important to know, do you have the range of motion? Great. Or if you don't, then we have to look at, well, why don't you have it? And we kind of break it out. Is it the joint? Is it the muscle? Is it tightness? Is it stiffness? Is it the Achilles tendon? Because that's a whole different ballgame if it's the Achilles. So we kind of find out, do you have the motion? And if you don't, it kind of trickles down into which box do you fall in? Where do you feel the limitation?
And is that something, figuring out the where the limitation comes from, is that possible to self-diagnose, or do you need to go see a physical therapist to do that?
Yeah, you can kind of self-diagnose it. And I talk in the book, it talks about like how to go through it. And like, kind of what I just said, if it's tight in the ankle, here's what you can do. If it's tight in the calf muscle, here's what you can do. So you can do it. It's a little more challenging. You just got to kind of know what you're doing. But you can go to a physical therapist and be like, hey, my ankle's tight. I just don't know like what's the issue with it. I don't know if it's a joint or not. So you can go to somebody, but if you kind of know what you're doing, you can, if a little bit of knowledge, you can know, hey, this is my calf is tight. I got to stretch it out. Or the ankle joint is tight. I'm going to grab a band. I'm going to do this ankle joint mobilization. So people can definitely do it on their own. They just, as long as you just kind of know what to look out for. So you can definitely know what's going on. And actually you can self-treat it. That is 100% possible.
So basically you're saying that if you're doing that lunge into the wall test, you're trying to then basically feel if you're not reaching the wall with the knee, okay, where is it that I'm feeling the pinch point, the limitation right now? Is it the ankle? Is it the calf? Yeah. And then based on that, you draw your conclusions essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much. And the ankle one, it's a really good, it's fairly simple. Cause it's, I think I really, it is kind of simple where anybody can diagnose it where, you just do the wall test, knee towards the wall. And as long as the knee stays in the middle of the foot and then the heel comes up, as long as if it touches the wall without the heel coming up, great. You might still feel some stiffness, but it's probably not going to be that, it's not going to be that limiting, but if the heel comes up, you can't touch the wall. All right. What's going on? What do you feel? Sometimes you feel nothing. It's like, all right, we got to just choose one and go with it. Something's limiting it. We just got to kind of go with it. But that's very rare. Most of the time we'll find the ankle's tight. I feel it around my ankle bone. It's pinchy, or I feel like a big stretch or a cramp in the calf. Like, hey, if it's calf stuff, let's do some calf work. Let's stretch it out. Let's do some lacrosse ball work on it. If it's the ankle, let's do some self joint mobilizations with it. As long as you got a big band, you can do those at home.
Yeah. How can you just very briefly say a bit more about that? If it's the ankle, how would you work on that mobility?
Yeah. So all we're trying to do is typically with the ankle, hopefully if you can see this here, it's as my knee goes over my toe, there's a roll and a glide that occurs in the ankle joint, and it's what we call the talus bone. If that gets tighter, that essentially there's a ball of connective tissue around it. It's not the bones that get tight, but it's just the connective tissue that hold the bone, kind of the bones together. If that gets tight, it limits the roll and glide of those bones, Michael. So if that roll and glide can't occur the right way, we tend to get, it rolls forwards, but doesn't glide backwards. It's like pinch, pinch, pinch. The bones hit each other. And you get that, or it'll kind of rub against the tissue and you'll get this like pinching sensation. So what we do with that is we want to stretch out the joint capsule. So we want to promote that roll and glide to occur the right way. So that's what essentially we kind of hook you up to a band. You put the band around your ankle and you just do these, like you just drive your knee over your toe a bunch of times and that helps stretch out the joint capsule. So it is, you could actually hold it too, but we tend to just kind of move into it and we move out. But that's how we can improve if it's the ankle itself, like there's pinching or it's tight around the ankle, it's not the Achilles, it's not the calf muscle. That tends to be how we improve it. There can be some other kind of like more detailed things that it's hard to explain those where like it could be other parts of the ankle, but that generally, if we're going to go, what are we going to get the most bang for our buck doing this self ankle mobilization with, I tend to use what they're called like pull up assistance bands. So if we're doing pull ups, sometimes it's hard to do them. So you kind of wrap a band around your feet and it helps you do the pull-up. That tends to work well to, you just kind of drive your knee over your toe, that bands are wrapped around your ankle, and it mimics, like if I had my hand there, it would mimic what my hand was doing to help improve your ankle mobility.
Right. Yeah. And can you give a couple of tips for if somebody diagnoses with limited hip extension, what would be the best ways to work on that as a first line of defense, let's say?
Yeah, from a mobility standpoint or just in general?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. From a mobility standpoint.
Yeah, I would just, it's funny, the couch stretch is the test, but it's also the treatment. So like, it's funny too, because like the ankle could be a crapshoot. It could be the ankle joint. It could be the ankle itself is stiff and you got to use, like typically stiffness, it'll be like one spot and it just gets stiff really quick. Like hit that with a lacrosse ball and if it's tender, keep working it. Or you got to stretch it out. You got to like stretch the calf out, statically hold it for like 2 minutes, 3 minutes. It's very boring. But there's different ways to improve it. If it's the Achilles, we'll do different kind of calf raises. That's a different ball game. But if we're talking about hip extension, a lot of times it's the quad, and we have typically with hip extension, we do these long duration holds, like hold the couch stretch for like 2 minutes. It's very long. It's watch TV, get on your phone, whatever. It's going to be it's probably very intense. So you're going to be like, this is the longest 2 minutes of my life. It's going to suck, but we tend to find really good results with that. You can do banded hip mobilizations. The hip joint itself can, it's a very stable joint. When we find with stable joints, they tend to be more tight. So you can wrap a band around your hip and kind of do these like lunging thrusts into, you know, like if you wrap it around a squat rack, you kind of loop the band right underneath your glute muscle and kind of lunge into the kind of hip thrust into the kind of where the band is. But hands down, the couch stretch is going to do, if we're looking at like, what's going to get us 80% the way there, it's probably just holding the couch stretch for like holding that for like 2 minutes. That we tend to have a lot more like muscle tightness or if we want to say fascia, that's fine too, but muscle tightness on for the quad muscle to improve hip extension. It, hands down, hold the couch stretch two, 3 minutes.
Right. Yeah. So one thing that I've heard about regarding stretching is that static stretching would be the recommended approach when we're talking about you're actually trying to lengthen the muscle, but then that's not always what you want to do for improving dynamic mobility for an activity like running, for example. But in this case, if you're holding the stretch for 2 minutes, we're talking about a static stretch, then it sounds like, is that, and maybe what I've understood is incorrect, but can you talk to us a little bit more about that? Why we're choosing static stretching, and is there a role for dynamic stretching, and when to choose which option?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question, because I think we have to understand like when to do dynamic stretching and when to do static stretching. So think static stretching as our goal is to, it's not to prepare you to run. Like it's not warming you up to run. If you're super stiff, actually it's not a bad idea to just like do a static stretch before you run. There's some negatives to it, but like we're doing static stretching. The whole goal, Michael, is we want to lengthen the tissue to allow your body to be able to move more efficiently, right? This isn't itself, it's not going to warm you up. It's not going to get your heart rate up. Like it's not like a warm-up exercise necessarily to do. Again, granted, if you're really stiff in the hips and you got a race coming up, it might actually be beneficial to do the couch stretch before your race, because it's going to allow you to get into that position that, again, is going to allow you to run more efficiently. So think of a static stretching as it's not going to be like an everyday thing. Eventually, you should be able to, like when someone starts out, like you're doing it every single day. As time goes on, maybe it's once a week, maybe it's twice a week. Eventually, you're not going to be able to do it. You don't have to do it as much. If you work as a lawyer and you sit a lot, right? Whatever your job is, and you travel, you're sitting, you're driving, you're in airplane, or you're flying all over the place for your job. Maybe we have to increase the frequency of it. And actually, the couch stretch, it does phenomenal work for people that have low back pain. So if you got low back pain, give the couch stretch a shot. That could really relieve some tension there. But when we're doing dynamic stretching, think of this as it's exercises meant to prime your muscles. It's turning your nervous system on. It's getting your heart rate up. It's getting your muscles ready to run. So two totally different reasons for why we're doing it. Where static stretching is, we have an issue with with you getting your leg behind you because your hips are tight. We'll want to open this up to make you a more efficient runner. Versus dynamic stretching is, the sole purpose of this is, let's get you ready to run. And we know we have a tweaky calf or a tweaky a hamstring. Hey, let's spend a little bit more time with maybe some more dynamic exercises. But one is to get you ready for running. Static stretching actually turns your muscle off. It sends a neural signal to whatever you're stretching. It sends a signal to that says, relax. But also that relaxation has the effect of turn off. So on the short term, static stretching really shouldn't be done before you run, because it it's going to inhibit muscle contractions, which if you're sprinting, definitely don't want that. But if you're distance running, you don't want that too. You want your muscles to be able to produce force and work the way they're supposed to. So really, for the most part, there are some cases where if you are super stiff, Michael, I might actually give you a static stretch before your run or your race, because I want you to have access to that range of motion, even though, yeah, we might turn the quad off. I'm willing to take that because I think you're going to get more benefit of running more efficiently with that leg behind you. So two different kind of reasons why we do them. Dynamic stretching is purely, hey, we're warming things up, getting you ready for your race or your run or your whatever it is. For static stretching, this is, we're doing things specifically to put you in a better position to then be able to run.
And if you're getting on that stretching protocol for your hip extension, you said that in the early phase, you would do it every day and you hold the stretch for 2 to 3 minutes, I guess, each side. But is that something that you would recommend doing multiple times a day? Or when you do it, is it 2 to 3 minutes one side, 2 to 3 minutes the other side, and then you're done? So you basically have a roughly 5 minute commitment per day to do that? Or is it 2 times 5 minutes, 3 times 5 minutes? How would you structure that?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I would do, around 2 to 3 minutes tends to be a good, like, 2 minutes is like the minimum where we're going to see some tissue change. You can, I give people once a day, you're going to get the minimum effective dose. Twice a day, now, if once a day you're a B student and twice a day you're an A student, who doesn't want to be an A student? So I would recommend doing it twice a day, but eventually, like, you'll know too, like, you'll start doing couch stretch, and then as long as you do it the right way, your knees are flush against the box or the wall, whatever you're using, or the couch, whatever you're using for you know, to prop that leg up behind you, you'll start to notice, like, after a week or even after 2 days, like, you should be getting higher and higher and higher and higher, and you might actually feel the stretch less and less and less. So you'll start to feel the difference, and then eventually, like, as you start to make progress, you don't have to do it as much. It's still eventually, I think most people, I still do it. I probably do it like once a week just to maintain my quad health. But eventually you'll get to a point where you don't need to do it as much, and you'll feel it. Like, you'll know, like, oh man, this is so much easier than when, like, I know when I have patients, it's like, oh, this is so much easier than when I saw you last week or than I saw you 2 weeks ago. So you'll be able to know, like, how you're making progress and if it's actually working or not. So that's a good question. But yeah, I tend to do it once or twice a week, or once or twice a day in the beginning. You do it twice a day, you're only going to get more benefit from it. So I do like the morning and then maybe before the run or after the run in the evening. Again, if you're really stiff, I don't mind doing it beforehand. It's just once you get that length back, it's almost like, well, now don't do it before the run, because now you're just going to turn your quads off. Let's do it afterwards. So maybe do more of a dynamic sort of a quad stretch. Just, you know, like I like to do grab your foot, kind of pull it behind you, and then you kind of like do these stretches up. And like, you could do more of a dynamic quad stretch versus the static hold. So I hope that answered that question. But yeah, I tend to see,
yep,
let's start out once or twice a day. You're going to feel the difference. And then as we start to progress on, maybe it's 2 times a week or 3 times a week. But as you get more flexible and more mobile, like, you don't have to do it as much.
That makes sense, yeah. Then just to wrap up on mobility, any common misconceptions about mobility that you see, that you think people have?
Sorry, what was the question? Sorry.
Common misconceptions around mobility.
Yeah, for runners. Yeah, I think I especially for runners, I think the common misconception is, like, you don't need to be mobile. Like, you don't have to have mobility. You just go out and run, because, like, a lot of the ranges, like, fair enough, like, there's not a lot of knee motion when you're running, right? It goes from, like, we don't hit the ground with a straight knee. It's maybe, I don't know, it's bent like 15 degrees, 20 degrees, whatever the knee is bent at when you hit the ground. And then when you push off, you get that swing phase, and it doesn't move a crazy amount, right? You don't need a whole lot of knee mobility. You don't need, your body rotates like a good amount, but it doesn't rotate all the way. So people think you don't need mobility. But I'll challenge that and say, and what's actually found in the research too, is when it's not just getting your leg behind you and having an efficient, like, push off position. But if we don't have mobility, like, if we don't have the full range of motion, the full mobility, let's say we have a neutral position, right? Let's say when I'm standing, let's just say that's my neutral hip position. And I can swing my leg forwards and backwards like a pendulum. Well, if my hips are tight and I can't get my leg behind me, well, now, as I say, if this is the range we had, this is forwards, this is backwards, this is the middle. Well, now our neutral position, if I can't get behind me, our neutral position has now went from here to here, right? So our resting neutral position has now changed. And this is why a lot of times with hip tightness, it shifts the pendulum forwards, where if I can't get my leg behind me, I will overstride to compensate for that. So if essentially we want to swing the pendulum back and have a more, we have more that neutral position to be a true neutral position. And If that still doesn't make sense, deadlifting, this is a huge issue with back issues when people deadlift, where if my hips are tight, especially if my back is tight, well, now my spine is all about mobility, and especially with all about being mobile at one point and then being stable at another point. So this is my spine position where we have this nice S curve. If all of a sudden my back's tight and I can't round my back, well, now our neutral position has now shifted into extension. So my back is naturally going to have more of essentially extension. It's going to be more curved. My S curve is going to be accentuated, or it's almost like an angle. It's like a wedge. So now when I deadlift, instead of bracing in a neutral position, my neutral position now feels like more hyperextension. It could be the other way too, where I don't have, I can't get extension. So now I'm pushed in deflection from my neutral position. So, and then someone throws their back out and they're like, well, man, my back's tight. I don't need a lot of back mobility when I deadlift. Like, I'm going to challenge that and say, you need full flexion and extension, full rounding and bending backwards in order to deadlift properly, because it allows you to find the neutral position and then brace and have a strong back in that neutral position. So mobility, a lot of people think, well, we might not need a lot of mobility when we run for certain areas. You definitely need it for the ankle. You definitely need it for the hip. But even if there's areas that don't need as much mobility, it throws off our neutral position. And that can cause issues. When you're deadlifting, that is huge. That's a part of how people throw their backs out when they lift, is their back is tight, whether rounding forwards or backwards. And now they try to lift heavy weights and their back keeps tweaking because they're not in a neutral position, and they're getting injured because of it. Sorry, that was a rant. a little bit of a rant on.
Yeah, no, that's a very good explanation. I've never heard it described like that, but I like it and it makes sense. Let's move on to strength training then. Nice segue from us talking about deadlifting.
Oh, yeah.
What are your thoughts on strength training?
It's huge. And I think I know you had questions too on, like, you know, what are some misconceptions we see with running, and especially with running, it's not as much a triathletes, but with running, I think people think that I have an injury, I have knee pain. A good example is I have a youth runner who she's going to run Division I this coming year at Bucknell. But, you know, she's super excited about it. I saw her she had a hip, I believe it was in her the neck of her femur. She had a stress fracture in her hip, and lots of things that go into stress fractures. But for her, as we were rehabbing her, and part of her process of rehabbing was lots of strength training, right? Loading the bone is how we build strength in the bone. Running is actually not good for bone density at all, which I know we want to talk about stress fractures too, but running's not really good for bone density. Strength training is amazing for bone density. That can help if you have a stress fracture, healing from it. We want to load you the right way and get that bone as dense as we can, and lay down as much bone material as we possibly can. But in her case, as we were rehabbing her, she did a lot of cross training, which this is a few cases where, hey, we want to cross train to keep our cardio generally up and keep, you know, just keep things at a general level. Yes, she's going to lose some fitness because she can't run, but we want to cross train to keep our heart and just keep our cardiovascular and endurance system, you know, just keep that up at least at some level, some capacity, where I think a lot of runners think I'm injured. Stress fracture, again, to come back from a stress fracture, we have to load your body. This is a necessity for a stress fracture. It took like 4 months to get back to running, but we had to do a lot of lifting and strength training for really for her. But people think that like cross training is I'm injured, I need to cross train. Like, you can cross train, but it's probably not going to solve the injury. Where a lot of issues with running is we have to load your body and we have to elicit tissue adaptation. And we have to, the way to do that is to overload the muscles. We have to be, when I give someone, you're going to do goblet squats for 10 reps. It's a 10 rep max. You should be very tired by the time you get to 10 reps. If not, we didn't use the right dosage or the right weight. So a big thing with misconception of strength training is people don't think they have to do it. And I think they think that cross training is, I just have to cross train. Like, we can cross train when you're injured. That's not going to solve the issue. We have to do some level of loading because muscles get stronger, tendons get thicker and stronger, ligaments get thicker and stronger. The joint capsule, that adapts as well and gets thicker. So when we strength train, there's so many benefits we get from it that, remember earlier, that allow us to handle the 2 to 2.5 times, 200% to 250% of your body weight on one leg every time you hit the ground. So that's why strength training is so important, is it allows you to handle the loads that running puts on your body.
Yeah. And what kind of, well, you mentioned that it needs to be an overload. You need to kind of load the body. But in terms of what muscle groups, what joints, what exercises, what does a strength training program look like for a runner? And I know that this might vary, but can you give some overarching thoughts on that?
Yeah. Runners, I love that question because we know what running is. Running is, it's a single leg hop over and over, an alternating single leg hop over and over again while you fall forwards. That's kind of the gist of running. That is the essence of running. You're falling forwards, you catch yourself, you push off, you just repeat that, you know, landing on opposite legs. So we know running, it's a plyometric exercise. It's jumping. So when we choose exercises, we want to choose things that mimic that. It doesn't have to be super specific all the time. But what I love to do is we know the calf is the most used muscle when we run. It could easily have, Michael, like, I think it's like 5 to 8 times your body weight. Like your calf, like your soleus muscle has to go through. Like every step you take, it's used a lot when you walk too. Walking, I think it's at least like 3 times your body weight. Like your soleus muscle is used so much. And just so people know, there's the gastrocnemius and there's a soleus. There's two calf muscles. Soleus, I think it's Latin. It says like, it means like flat fish because it looks like a fish. It's kind of it's an interesting looking muscle. But the soleus, I mean, it can go. It is, when you're running, it's the powerhouse muscle. So we want to make sure that muscle is strong. And guess what? I might be a broken record, Michael, but running does not make you stronger. It uses, think of it, it's using that muscle, right? It's like a rubber band. You stretch it and contract it and stretch it and release it over and over and over again. Well, if you keep doing that and the rubber band, right, if it's a dry rotted rubber band, if it's not a thick rubber band, that's able to handle the stretch over and over and over again. Well, that's how people have calf issues, and chronic calf tightness tends to be actually a strength issue. So, a big thing to strength train is the soleus, which is it's actually more of a bent knee calf raise. I do straight leg calf raises all the time. You're going to hit it, but I love incorporating not just straight knee calf raises, but you kind of bend that knee and you keep it bent as you go through calf raises. So that's a big one is the soleus. Hamstring is the second most used muscle when you're, especially distance. It's used a lot when you're sprinting, but it's definitely used a lot when you're distance running. So like hamstring curls, more single leg. I love doing kickstand deadlifts where it's more of like of a bias, kind of a, instead of just doing a normal deadlift, it's you kind of kick one leg behind. It's like almost like a lunge, kind of a deadlift. I just call it a kickstand deadlift. So with running, we know it's a single leg exercise. Let's do more single leg exercises. A kickstand deadlift, a Bulgarian split squat. I love getting runners heavy on a Bulgarian split squat. There's a lot of benefits to it. You load one leg, right? It's like a single leg squat, essentially. The back leg, as you go down, actually stretches out the quad. So you get a mobility benefit from it. There's a little bit of a balance because you have to balance on one leg. And then you strengthen one leg. So I guess if I had to grade them, big fan of Bulgarian split squats, big fan of like a kickstand deadlift, and also a soleus calf raise is also huge.
Yeah, no, that all makes a lot of sense. I think that pretty much covers it for, well, actually maybe a little bit of practicality with strength training. How would you, for a typical runner, how many times a week would you recommend to do strength training, and how much time roughly do you think that one should invest into strength training?
Yeah, I'm actually glad you asked that because it's, I have a few runners who I do like their remote programming. So like some of them I've seen for injuries, and now it's just like maintenance mode. Like, we just build out programs for some runners. And when I'm building it out, I remember learning this from Ryan Hall, who I don't know if he still does, but he used to have like the American record for, I think it was the marathon and the half marathon. So, I mean, it's a very well-known runner in the States. And I remember learning from him that like when he was running marathons and training, he would only strength train like twice a week. Because he's just... We can't have the strength training tail wag the running dog. So we're not like, if you truly are a triathlete and truly are, hey, I'm taking running seriously and I want to be the best I can be at it. Like there's a time and place for strength training. There's a time and place where we don't need to do it. Like if you're in the off season, you just ran a marathon, you're recovering, you don't have another marathon for like, or another race for like 4 months, 5 months, 6 months. Now is the best time. Minimize the running. Right, you could probably strength train 3 times a week, maybe even 4 if you wanted to, and that might be a little bit too much. But typically, 3 to 2 times a week tends to be this nice number for runners to do. Even I think triathletes is probably a good number as well. And then as the season goes on, as you ramp up your running, we just drop the training session. So let's say maybe you have a 4 month plan. I think the first month would be definitely heavier on the lifting, and you're getting back into running. Second month, maybe 2 to 3 times a week, still lifting, maybe maybe still progressing a little bit, kind of keeping the base, third month keeping the base, and then for the fifth month, we're going to definitely drop it to twice a week and then maybe drop some of the lifting where it's not as intense. So for the most part, I think most runners would do very well 3 times a week lifting or working out, dedicating 40 minutes to an hour, somewhere around there. And then as you get closer to your race, it's probably going to drop it to that like 2 months beforehand, probably drop it to twice a week. And then definitely not lifting as aggressively or as heavy. But also part of this is plyometrics. And I love sneaking in plyometrics when we can, because it's actually great for bone density. Right? We're going to talk about bone stress injuries eventually, Michael. So this is just all precursors to it. But the strength training is great for that. But I love doing plyometrics before running, because if you can strength train before you run, it's actually not a bad thing either. If you're a professional runner, you got all the time in the world, like that's fine. The problem is there's an inhibitory effect on our bone cells after we run. It's almost like they've experienced all this single leg hopping over and over and over and over again. They're kind of just like, think of it like the bone cells get bored of it. They're like, we're kind of bored of this stimulus. We're good. If you do plyometrics and you do strength training afterwards, you won't get as much of a bone density response versus if you did it beforehand. So the minimum effective thing you can do is if you do some 5 minutes of plyometrics before you run, you could use a curb. I call them alternating plyos, where you kind of hop on and off the curb and be quick about it. Doing your plyos before you run is a great way to maintain bone density, but you just have to be quick and aggressive with it. So I know I kind of went on a little bit of a tangent, but hopefully that all makes sense. Of typically 3 to 2 times a week for strength training, as we get closer to our race, you know, we can drop that to even once a week. It's fine to taper off. But doing plyometrics and even strength training before you run helps you get the most out of most for your bone density.
Yeah, makes sense. And then let's talk about the foot a bit. And because you have a chapter in your book about the foot stability and the importance of the foot functioning well for runners. So can you start with giving an overview on that, and then I'll have some follow-up questions on it.
Yeah, the foot. I'm glad we're talking about this, because I'm working on another book that's all about foot health. It's just this, I think there's definitely a lot more people talking about foot health. And, you know, I have a flat foot, or I've been told you got a flat foot, you have to wear this kind of shoe. I don't know. I just never liked that. And I never felt like the shoe was actually solving the issue. Like you overpronate, Matt, you got to get this shoe. And I'd go to the shoe store and I'm like, yeah, that's fine. But I just never felt like it was work. I always felt like my flat feet were like an issue and it was holding me back from running. And it probably did contribute to some issues like the knee pain and back pain I had. I'm sure the foot collapsing, and if the foot collapses down and it can't be as stiff as it should be, the knee will cave in and the hip will drop and then your back. So I think it can cause a lot of issues, but foot health for me is, especially for runners and people that are really active, is it's the first thing that hits the ground. It has to be doing its job. And when we're putting our feet, in shoes that are kind of putting our feet in certain positions, the front of the shoe is squishing on our forefoot, is squishing our foot, right? It's causing there's typically a forefoot rocker where it's curved up, and that actually curves up it causes your toes to get curved up, which it's just all these things, and all the stack height that tends to turn off, all these things in these shoes that are, they're actually deconditioning and are turning our feet off. Now I'm going to preface this. I'm not anti Hoka. I'm not anti, if you love wearing high cushion shoes, I know I went on a retreat there's a running club called Run Free Training, and a lot of guys there, they love their shoes. I'm like, and they're like really good. Like the guy runs a 2:30 marathon or like a 4:20 mile, like really good runners, talented runners that are like, I love wearing Hokas. I'm like, I'm not going to tell you not to wear Hokas. If you love wearing them, like, go for it. All I'm saying is these shoes, that we have to do something if we're not going to change the way we wear shoes, we have to do something on the back end to get our foot to activate and be stronger and just make healthier choices when it comes to shoe wearing and when it comes to our feet. So a big thing we find, like in my case, I have a flatter foot. I think a lot of people are in my boat where, hey, we've been told we have to wear these shoes. I don't like wearing those shoes. I think they're big and clunky and bulky. What can we do? Well, it actually doesn't matter too much about your arch height. A little bit it does. What we found in the research is when we look at, like, let's say societies, or just, you know, you go to, somewhere random in Africa, they'll have differences of foot height, where arch height, where there's higher arches and lower arches. But in this kind of more developed in the Western world, we have extremes of that. We have very, very high arches and we have very, very low arches. So what we're finding is It actually doesn't matter too much if you have a high or low arch. Can we just get the arch active? And in our society, we got to do a little bit. We just really have to work a little bit harder at it because we just have the extremes. We have people that have super, super high and super just rigid, stiff feet. And we have people, like, I don't know if I'm on this extreme, but we have people that have just really, really hypermobile feet that we have to stiffen and train. So think of, it doesn't matter what your arch height typically is. If it's higher, we have to turn your arch on to be a shock absorber. Right now, like you're going off a mountain, you're trying to mountain bike with a road bike, and it's not going to feel very good. If you're me, on my end, my arch muscles don't want to stiffen. Like I have this foot that hits the ground, it just collapses, right? I have a mountain bike where the shocks are just so shocky. I get no energy return. I don't really, it's almost like you have a bike that has like too much shock absorption. Like you're just like bouncing all over the place and it's like, it just doesn't feel very good. So in one case, we got to give you shocks. If you have a too stiff or high of an arch, it's classically what we call it. But in my case, in many people's case, if you have a flatter foot or a more hypermobile foot, well, we just have to learn to stiffen that. And in both cases, I mean, in the stiff foot, we can definitely release some things and do some mobility work. But actually, in both cases, Michael, we are turning the foot on. We're strengthening the foot. And if you have the foot like mine is, where it's hypermobile and you quote unquote overpronate, well, as you get the arch more active, it'll start to stiffen that foot. So I don't care how flat your foot is. I care how much it flattens when you're moving. So if we can stiffen that arch up, statically I don't care what it looks like, but actively I want to have I don't want to pronate as much. I want to stiffen it. And then guess what? On the other side, if you have a foot that's more stiff, if we start to activate the arch muscles, those will act as a shock absorber. So like essentially, like your bones are just your foot's so just stiff and tight. A lot of people are actually at a higher risk of stress fractures in their foot that have the higher arch foot, and they tend to roll the ankle more. We want to bring more awareness to your foot. We want to get your arch muscles stronger so they can allow your foot to spread out, and they kind of help it absorb shock. So you want the muscles to absorb the shock versus your joints, your ankle joint and your foot joints, because that's going to cause a lot of, like we call it metatarsalgia, just metatarsal pain, foot pain, or even a stress fracture in the foot. So we have two different foot types, two different foot issues that can both be fixed. And the solution is get your arch more active. That, guess what? We tend to find shoes with cushion and heel rockers and 4-foot rockers and narrow toe boxes tend to turn our feet off. So we can get our foot more active and stronger. And we could talk about ways to do that, Michael. Both of these issues of the high arch and the low arch foot, they tend to be resolved by getting your foot more active and stronger.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. How do you actually achieve that?
Yeah, number one is, I mean, there's two things you can do. Number one is, and this is what I'm working on in my new book right now, is if you transition to a barefoot style shoe, even just walking, not even running, just walking in a barefoot style shoe, that has been shown to improve arch strength. And certain muscles, like there's a muscle that like move your pinky toe around, that move your big toe around. And that flex your toes into we don't want to scrunch the toes. We want to like press them down. Those muscles get bigger. Those muscles get, I think the research, like there's fancy ways they say it. There's the surface area. They look at like the volume of the muscle. It's kind of interesting how they word it. But wearing barefoot style shoes, that's one thing. You can just make that change. And as long as things aren't crazy weak, we can make that transition and get just walking in a more minimal style shoe, which is less cushion, wider toe box. You're going to see changes. A big, big part of this, Michael, is there's something called, it's called a tie rod mechanism. Yeah, just a simple way to think about this is my forefoot. If it's squeezed in the shoe, there's actually a ligament that spans your forefoot. If that ligament, it's, when you hit the ground, your toes are supposed to splay out and spread out, and the forefoot's supposed to widen. That's a great thing because it sends a signal to your brain that says, we just hit the ground, we should probably stiffen the arch. And then your brain sends a signal back to your arch muscles and some of your shin muscles that says, hey, stiffen up, get like contract essentially. So there's this mechanism. I mean, it happens. Less than milliseconds it happens, Michael. But it's this, when our foot spreads out, when we hit the ground, when we're walking and running, our brain gets a signal and the brain sends a signal back that says, turn the arch muscles on. And that's every step you take when walking and running. So we're in a shoe that is restricting this and our toes are stuck together. Well, that's going to limit our ability to actually activate our arches. So if we can improve the mobility of the let the forefoot splay, right? Use a toe spacer, get the toe spread out. And a lot of people have bunions. I actually have a little bit of a Taylor's bunion, which is on the pinky toe. I do a lot of work to get that toe spread out and strengthen my arches. That is that's a huge part of why barefoot shoes work so well, is they allow your foot to spread out with a wide toe box. That is huge when it comes to turning your arch on. So part of it is, if we just make the transition safely and health and do it the right way into a more barefoot shoe, again, less stack height, less foam, wider toe box, and no big heel. You want a flat shoe, as long as your ankle mobility is there. That's where we see a lot of benefit from just wearing barefoot shoes. It's going to help stiffen your arch. It's also, again, if you have a higher arch, it's going to help get those arch muscles to act as a shock absorber. Do you have any questions on that before I move on to the...
So what if you... Yeah, just general wider toe box shoes. Does that serve some of that same purpose if you were a normal shoe, but just with a wide enough toe box that you have space to display the toes within it?
Yeah, you can, right? You could be like, hey, I just want to... Let's say if they had a... I don't know. I know they make like Ultra... I'm a big fan of Ultra. That tends to be a wider toe box shoe, but they have some higher stack shoes, and I still wear them. Ultra is a really good in between, where you can get like, you know, the Escalante, very minimal stack height, or you can get like I sometimes run in my Paradigms, and there's no drop. There's very little, like, you know, 4 foot lift. There's very little like twisting or very little like curvature of the shoe. So it's a very good medium where you get this wide toe box, you get all that benefit. Plus, hey, you might not be ready for barefoot. Like, that's great for like, hey, I'm not ready for this like really minimal. I wear these zero shoes. Running in this is a lot for people, right? Running in a shoe that has nothing on it, like there's no cushion. It's a lot for people to handle. So I'm a big fan of wearing something like an Ultra, where if you're running, it's a great option because you can still get some cushion and like help it just keep that foot doing a lot, helping the foot continue to do a lot of the work. But also, I get it. If you're a nurse, you walk on concrete all day, it might be not the most comfortable thing to have no cushion. So they also make, it's not the Vibram Five Fingers. It's the, I think it's Paluva. They make, again, as long as your friends aren't going to make fun of you at work or your coworkers, but it's a toe shoe that has a little bit of cushion. But it's a very good shoe of like, hey, I'm walking on concrete all day. I can't wear this like actual barefoot shoe. I just need something with a little bit of cushion. There's a lot of shoes out there that are wide, that have a little bit of cushion. There's no heel lift. That help kind of bridge that gap between, you know, I just can't, it's not comfortable to wear a barefoot shoe. Here's a shoe that has a little bit of cushion that's this great intermediate option for you.
And the other follow up is, what about people that might actually be working? Well, I guess this is especially people that work from home. Mm-hmm. They might be just barefoot or just wearing their socks all day. So when you're walking around in the house in your socks, maybe you do some strength training at home just wearing socks, or doing your strength training barefoot. Does that help you?
Yeah. If you could be barefoot, or I'm wearing toe socks right now. I'm a big fan of toe socks. Even just having, you know, it's not a shoe that's squishing you together, but just being able to feel that your toes are separate and they can move independently, or just, you know, that there's that space between them. I have patients that I think I had a 79-year-old patient. He stopped coming in for a little bit, but he had two bunionectomies. I think he has two big toes that are fused, and he wears the toe socks. He swears by them. I'm like, he actually got me into them. This was like later last year. I'm like, let me try this. And it's really weird the first time you do it, but then it's like, oh, this feels great. This feels good. Like, you want your toes to be able to spread out and. I got to look at the research. I don't know if there's any research on toe socks and foot activation, but just from a personal experience, from patients I've seen, there's a benefit to it. And I can take it with a grain of salt, but I'm a big fan of toe socks in more wider toe box shoes, because it just helps you want to spread the toes out. And again, it's going to help that tie bar mechanism it's going to help that arch activate simply just by being in a wide shoe, but also have your toes want to be able to spread out.
Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, I think you said that there were two things that we were going to talk about that we could do. What was the second one?
It start to work on your foot. Yes, the easiest one is to buy a different shoe. Like, but part of that is, like, in my new book I'm writing now, like, it's like I made this whole system of, your foot doesn't have to be perfect to start to wear to walk in a barefoot shoe, but we should at least have a couple boxes checked. And there's a couple tests we can do where, can you do toe yoga? Can you keep your forefoot on the ground and lift your big toe separately from the other four toes, right? Can you do this without your foot wobbling all over the place? And you'd be amazed. I was like, people have such difficulty performing toe yoga. I don't care about picking up marbles. Like, that's not, I mean, if you want to do that, that's bonus points. But can you just differentiate the big toe from the other four toes? can you press your big toe into the ground without curling it? Can you press that down into the ground and feel and see your arch activate? Do you have full ankle mobility, right? That's a big one for transitioning to a barefoot shoe, because most traditional shoes have some level of a heel lift that it helps us. It doesn't help propel us forwards. It just unloads the Achilles and the calf. So our calf doesn't have to work as hard. So we have to have calf strength. We have to have calf mobility as well. So there's certain boxes I want to at least have checked before we make that transition. But imagine if you improved your arch strength, you perform these press downs, right? You performed these balance exercises. You're performing, you stand on the ball, your foot pass away from side to side. You're doing all these arch exercises and you're wearing barefoot shoes. Well, now we're getting the benefit of both of these simultaneously. So I'm a huge fan of, let's get you to a barefoot shoe. If you don't want to run in it, totally fine. I'm not going to push. I would never push someone to run in barefoot shoes unless they wanted to. I personally do it. I enjoy it. I don't do it all the time because sometimes I'm like, hey, I don't think my foot's ready to do this. I put on the Ultra, I believe it's the Paradigm, and I wear that instead. But if we can walk in barefoot shoes and also do arch strengthening, that's a recipe for success when you want to improve your arch, just your foot health. You got a high arch or a low arch, wherever you are on this extreme, these are things that we know can help is wear a barefoot shoe, proof arch activation. There's some mobility stuff too, right? You can put your foot on a golf ball and start moving around. There's a lot of intrinsic, a lot of just mobility work we can do, especially if you got that more a higher arched foot. But for the most part, we will put you in a more minimal shoe. We get your arch activated. A lot of great things can happen.
Great. And I guess one final question on this topic, because I don't think that we properly explained it or I didn't properly ask about it, but what is the test? Is there a couch test for your feet to know yeah. whether you need to do some kind of intervention or what your level of need in terms of the foot is?
Yeah. Again, I'm going through it. I'm actually putting this in my book, my new book right now. So it's fresh in my head. There's a couple you could do. Like an easy one is the calf raise test, right? Like we know, like if you're in a more barefoot style shoe, you're going to have more calf strength. So I'll have people get on a slant board, hold a 20, sometimes even a 30-pound weight. Can you do 20 3-second up, 3-second down calf raises while holding that 30-pound weight while on the slant board, right? We're going for 20. It's just a good test. Even if you don't complete it, I want to know where you're at and are there differences. The goal is to complete it, but that's kind of like minimum standard. But if you only get the 10 reps, okay, hey, your calf might be weaker than we want it to be. And then a month later, 2 weeks later, now it's at 15, now it's at 20. Great, we made some changes. So there's a calf raise test we can do. The toe yoga, that's a test. It's an exercise and a test. A lot of them are kind of exercises and tests in themselves. Or if you start out and you can't differentiate, you're like, I don't know what I'm doing, practice that. Let's do some releases of the foot. Let's press the big toe down. Let's start to work on this. And then over time, hopefully you see that toe yoga improve. So I think a calf raise test is a good one. The toe yoga test. What's another good one? I think there's a couple things with the glute as well. Like there's like a single leg glute bridge test. Can you hold a single leg hip thrust, like a glute bridge, and not drop the hip at all? There's a lot of hip influence on what the foot does. I guess those are just three, but there are some tests we could do. The toe yoga test tends to be good. Sometimes I'll even do, you can press your big toe down on like a piece of paper. And we don't want to see any scrunching of the toes, but just pressing down. Is it hard for me to pull that paper from underneath your big toe, right? Like press the big toe on the paper. Is it hard for me to pull that piece of paper out? And then we'll also do it on the other four toes. Again, these four toes, it's really easy to see that scrunching. You want to be able to like press the four toes down, the pinky toe included, without seeing scrunching. And it's going to be a little bit weaker than the four toes than the big toe. But hey, do I still have some, is this paper to fly right out of there? Or can you actually press down and do I feel some resistance on this piece of paper? Those are just four tests quickly of like, hey, can we? Here's how we can actually assess some foot health. And actually, I want to buy this thing. You can get it where you put your big toe on it, you pull it. It actually gives you a number of how much force your big toe was able to handle and the other four toes. So we can actually quantify it. But you've got to spend a little more money to get that little device. So in a pinch, let's use the paper. Can I pull aggressively? And can you keep that paper there?
Yeah, no, that's all good. And perhaps the next topic could have been placed in conjunction with the general strength training, but let's talk a bit about specifically core training. Mm. What are your thoughts on core training and what role it plays for runners?
Yeah, core is huge. Core is, when we talk about running, there's lots of rotation. So when we're rotating, it's all core. I mean, it is a lot of hips too. So it's not just I move in this one plane. It's not this forwards, backwards plane of motion, which running, it's only forwards anyway. But like there's lateral force. So there's force that kind of kicks you out to the side, which I believe is, it's like 15, 20% of your body weight. So it can be, sometimes you see people run, they kind of like have this head bob to one side. They're loading their body too much in that plane on that side. So like they have a mobility issue, whatever the issue is, like sometimes people just have this thing where they're had this excessive sideways motion. And if we strengthen your core in that plane of motion and the side to side motion, or strengthen your body that way, we'll probably limit that. Essentially, you're overloading your body in that direction that can cause issues. So definitely doing plank side planks is great. I'm a big fan of side planks. Front planks are okay, but we don't want to miss out on the most important part of the core, which is rotation. Think of this as, we call it a spinal engine, where as we move forwards, we're not just moving forwards, we're not just bouncing side to side too as we go forwards. There's rotate. This is why, like, you see someone run, you're like, man, they look choppy. It just doesn't look that good. Or you see someone run, you're like, man, they look fluid. Like, this guy is, he's a runner. Like, he or she is moving. That when you see someone and they look efficient and they're just effortlessly moving, they're optimized. Yes, the running form's on point, but part of this is rotation, and we call it counter rotation. And part of it is the core, where it's not just doing a side plank or a front plank. Let's do some exercises where, you know, a pallet press with the rotation out to the side. Let's do some exercises where we're adding rotation in, and make sure you have the mobility to rotate, but also teaching you when you're running, how do I rotate the right way? Which one of my favorite cues is I learned this recently. It's called the belly button cue, where when you're running, whatever foot is in front of you, when it hits the ground, you want your belly button pointing that direction. So if my left foot hits the ground, I want my belly button, I'm going to rotate towards that left side. My right foot hits the ground, I'm going to rotate towards the right side, like my upper body, and my belly button is going to rotate towards that side. Rotation, the core, part of it is, we do have to resist kind of forwards, backwards, and side to side motions, but I think 70% of it is, can we optimize our rotation? And a lot of that rotation is making sure we know, maybe we have rotational strength, but we know how to move and coordinate rotation as we run.
And is a big part of that then is simply doing specific exercises, core exercises, or is there a part that is integrated within running drills or something?
Yeah, it's both. Yeah, you want to have the core be able to contract and be strong that way. So like there's banded exercises we can do. There's a lot of stuff on like a physio ball, like the exercise ball you can do. But part of it also is like you got to have the strength, but you got to know how to use the strength. So, and one of my favorite cues is you'll actually if you're on a treadmill, hold the PVC pipe out in front of you, and then walk on it and have that belly button hit the, you know, left, right, left, like, so you'll go like, you know, left, right, but it forces, if you can't use your arms, it really forces you to have to rotate. So I love, you can go behind the back too. Let's take your arms out of the equation, because like a lot of people cheat where like their body doesn't move. It's just all the arms are doing like all the rotation, which is fun. You can kind of get away with that, but if we don't let you use your arms, use your core to help. Like the whole point of this is your core muscles. It's using the fascia and it's using your muscles. Where if I'm running, right, my left leg's behind me, I'm rotating to the right, my right foot's about to hit the ground. There's a stretch of my core is contracted one way and it's stretched the other way. So when I go the other way, I'm doing this when I run. I'm rotating. There's a quick stretch and a quick contraction. So you get this. It's almost like a plyometric. Quick stretch, quick contract, quick stretch, quick contraction. But also the fascia system's doing that as well. It goes from like, there's different fascial lines and your left leg behind you and you're rotating to the right. There are certain fascial tissues that are stretched. And the same thing, they give you free energy. So when we go back to the beginning of the podcast and we talk about the importance of running form and free energy, if we can optimize rotation, that is a low-hanging fruit where you get so much free energy from. So if we can, you have to have some level of strength just to help handle the rotation. But if you can get the mobility, Michael, if you can get the strength, and if you can, the hardest part I think is actually learning to integrate it into your running. But that cue of like, you know, walking first and then focusing on your belly button has a, I call it like a laser. You know, if it's got a laser pointing straight out in front of you, it looks kind of, it sounds weird. But have that laser when you're running left, right, left, right, left, right. That's a great way to start to get that. And I'm implementing this myself recently, and I'm like, it feels better. Because sometimes it's like, I know I need to rotate, but where do I rotate from? The belly button cue, rotating from L1 to T12 is actually, that's a big spot of rotation. So if we can rotate there, that is, if you teach people to do that, that is half the battle of people probably, a lot of people have the mobility and the strength, they just don't know how to use it. Let's teach you how to use that through it's called the belly button cue, or the laser cue.
Yeah. By the way, I have to say that I love that you have all of these cues, because that's, personally, I just think that that's an effective way of motor learning and skill acquisition compared to, for example, isolation drills. And I see it in swimming that when you have somebody in the pool and you maybe give them a drill to work on something and then you tell them, okay, now swim normally and let's see what it looks like. And then nothing has changed. But when you actually... But when you instead just have them swim, but using certain cues, and maybe you use a couple of different ones to achieve the same goal, and one of them might work better than the other, and then you repeat that with the cue. I just, for me in general, that's not always the case, but normally I think that that's for what I've seen at least the better way of improving a certain motoric skills, I would say. So that's just as a general comment on all these cues that you have been giving us, I really like that. So one more follow-up on the core strength. So what if you can give maybe four or five top exercises that people should consider adding to their rotation, pun intended, their rotation?
I would definitely practice the, what's it called? Practice the belly button cue. Like just do that, like just walk before you run and put your arms behind your back. You can hold something really light overhead. Practice it. You can start to get heavier with it too, like holding a very light, like I think Dr. Mark Cucuzella, someone, a mentor I've had, amazing physician, just knows a lot about running. He has people hold like a metal rod that you get at Home Depot or Lowe's, right? Just hold that. You get progressively heavier with it. Hold something a little bit heavier overhead. That's a great way to train it, because now if you mastered it when you're walking, you know, left, right, you could add a little bit of weight to it. Like more weight you have, it's just going to help that core. The core is going to have to work a little bit harder to rotate you. So I'm a big fan of walking with, as long as your shoulders can handle it, with a little bit of weight overhead on a treadmill, you can walk outside too. I just love using a treadmill for it. So that's one thing is we can start to, we know the cue. We can actually load the cue a little bit just to challenge the core a little bit more. I'm a big fan planks aren't bad, but I like moving in and out of planks. So like for side planks, I'll actually do, you know, like go up and down, slow and controlled, right? We're not just holding the side plank. I want you to drop the hips, bring it back up. Drop the hips, bring it back up. So I love doing that with side planks. And also like, I love doing like a side plank into a rotation. So I'll even have a light weight on my side. So if I'm here and I'll kind of like open up. So my upper back is like my hips stay level. My upper back has to rotate as I'm holding the side plank. So I think that's a good one. I love doing, it's like a front plank to a, like there's a band tied here. And I have to open up and slowly control the way back down. I guess if anything, you can just add movement to your side planks with a band or a weight. I think that's a great thing to do, where you don't have to stay rigid. Again, with running, we know we have to move. It's a time and place for it. We can do rigid stuff. We can do anti-rotation. Big fan of it. But also, we have to be, we call it counter-rotation, where essentially your upper body rotates one way, the lower body rotates the other way. I didn't get too much into it, but there's exercises we can do where like we just want to add rotation to the movements, and taking your side planks and adding rotation to them is probably the easiest thing for people to do, because they're already used to doing side planks. Let's add some rotation to your side planks or to your front planks too.
Yeah, makes sense. We're running quite low on time, so we might need to skip a little bit ahead here in the questions we had. I'm going to jump to the question about special considerations for triathletes. We have talked a lot about running here today, and running injuries is the big part of triathlon injuries. But triathletes, for example, will often ride a lot in the TT position, which has implications perhaps for how tight they get and so on. Even the use of fins can have implications for ankle flexibility and so on in the pool. So in general, what would you say that triathletes should think about that might not necessarily apply to runners?
Yeah, I think, I mean, from the running standpoint, the easiest thing is going to be that Z angle, getting as much hip extension, getting as much ankle mobility as you can. But when you're talking, especially with the cycling, you know, there, I think of cycling as it's active sitting, right? If you take your cycling position and then you kind of put yourself where you're facing forwards, I mean, you're just in like this seated position. So you're not really getting as much hip extension. You're not really getting like your back's kind of in this rounded position for, you know, hours, however long it takes you to whatever race you're doing. So I think making sure we have a mobile back, like middle of the back, a mobile back, because you get off that bike, now you got to go run and you've just been stuck in this rotated, you've stuck in this flex position the whole time. So making sure I would do with getting off the bike is focus on the belly button cue of you've just been in this stiff position for your back for whatever, how many hours it's been, however the time limit's been. Make sure we're rotating when we're running. That's going to help you complete that 5K, or if you're doing an Ironman at the marathon, half marathon, whatever you're doing at the end, for the end of that triathlete or triathlon. I would make, because you just came off of, your back was stiff for X amount of time. Let's give yourself a cue. Just focus on that when you're starting out in the run, but also making sure you have the mid back mobility. It's not just triathletes that get this. It's just runners have this all the time too, where we're just really tight here. Let's do some things to open the back up. Laying on a foam roller is the most common thing people do, but you can get it's called a peanut, which is like two lacrosse balls taped together that flanks where your backbone is. And that's even more intense, but having mid back mobility, I think, is huge. But also too, same thing, you get off that bike, you've been seated for so long, your hips are probably going to be tighter. I think a lot of triathletes probably have tightness in the mid back and tightness in the hip flexors because that seated position on the bike. And my favorite cue is it's really hard to cue hip extension, like push farther with your leg or push behind you. It just doesn't work very well. I love cueing. I'm gonna get my camera angle down here. I love cueing. I don't like saying tight. I think keeping the arms close, not letting them come out and farther in front. Like if you can focus on close arms with a farther back elbow position, the legs will follow the shoulders. The legs follow the elbows. So if you get your arms farther back behind you, guess what? You will also get that. You'll probably get a better push off position behind you. So I think for triathletes, it's definitely going to be mid back mobility and hip extension mobility are going to be huge. And some short-term things, you're middle of the race, you're like, shoot, I can't do anything in the middle of a race. Focus on the belly button cue. Focus on when you're running. Keep the arms close and accentuate that backwards, because it helps the cadence and it helps get that push-off position, because we just know you just sat for an hour, 2 hours, however long it took. But on the when you're not racing, hey, making sure you're doing some mid-back mobility and you're also doing some hip, like the couch stretch and the like laying on that we call it the peanut. You can look it up on Amazon. Those are things I think really help a lot of triathletes.
Yeah, that's great. And what about overrated and underrated? So this can be products, concepts, misconceptions even, yeah, when it comes to especially injury prevention and or rehabilitation. So can you think of some things that you would consider overrated or underrated in the general, in the public eye?
I'll give you one for each. Overrated is for triathletes, not as much, but like just for runners, it's a little bit more of an issue of cross training is not going to solve your issue. It will keep your heart going. It'll keep some level of metabolic conditioning and some endurance, but it's not going to solve your knee pain. Cross training is not the solution for an ankle pain or injury. We have to load you. We have to find out, was it running form? Is it mobility? I think cross training for runners, overrated. I mean, you know, I know triathletes do brick workouts. You guys are running, swimming, and biking. You have to do the cross training. But if you have an issue, don't just avoid running. Do go see somebody. B, you have to probably load the issue or find out what that has a root cause. We have to find out what that root cause is. The most underrated thing is I don't get paid by these guys at all. I do have like an affiliate link, but I don't really care that much about it. If you're going to use it, go for it. I wear these all the time. They're called Barefoot Science insoles. They are designed, it's not an orthotic. There's like no, it's not putting your foot in any position. There's a time and place for orthotics. This is simply an insole there's different ones, different spacers that go inside of here. And this is on your foot. Your foot senses this tactile feedback, and it helps turn your arch on. There's like a rock mat people get where they stand on it when they're working at home, and it helps turn their foot on. It's got these little bumps on it. It's the same exact idea, but it's an insole. So when you put this on, the different thicknesses, I'm on like the second highest thickness. I'm going to move to the other one soon. You sense this, and it at first it feels like I got this pressure in my foot. Well, as your foot senses that, it's going to contract the toes and it's going to lift. Your foot is going to lift off of this, and the byproduct of that is you have a more stiff foot, which is great if you're like me and I have a more hypermobile foot. Even if you have a higher arch, you can still use this because it's gonna help turn the arches on. So it's good for any kind of foot issue. But this is the most underrated thing. I don't think they get as much attention as they deserve. And the guy who owns it, his name is Lance. He passed away a few months ago. I didn't even know that. I talked to him like a week before he passed away. So I think it was kind of sudden. And so he was older, but kind of sad. But I got to talk to him. I kind of pick his brain about how these work. And the research is old and it's been there for forever. We've had this research about tactile cueing for your foot turns your arch on. That's a big issue. There's one issue with minimal style shoes. It's that you feel the same feedback every step you take, right? You feel the outsole. You feel the rubber sole of the shoe. Sure, you might feel a pebble if you're walking in a mountain, but when we're actually barefoot, we feel these different sensations, and our brain loves feeling different things. It craves that, and then it when you feel certain different movements and feel different surfaces, it turns your foot on. This does that by giving your foot something to sense every single time it hits the ground. So very underrated. I don't think they get as much attention. I don't see anybody who's big into like foot health, like on Instagram or any influencers talking about this. But I champion these guys because every single person I recommend these to, they're like, hey man, they're kind of expensive. They're like $90, but then I got them and they worked. Like my arch is actually working. So this can be a great thing to add on to. Not that I'm trying to have you spend more money, but if you want to do it and you want to try these out, big fan of Barefoot Science insoles. They have different kinds. Not a sales pitch. It's just I only really use products I believe in. There's very few. There's like the Mobo board from Jaded Cherry. There's these guys. I just like Zero Shoes because I think they're not overpriced, the $200 for a minimal style shoe. But there's a few things I promote and because I truly believe them. This is one of those things that if anybody wants to turn their arch on, highly recommend Barefoot Science insoles if you want to kind of step your game up with that, with turning your foot on.
Nice. Yeah, that's really interesting. I've never heard of them. What would you say is the 80-20 message of today's interview? So if listeners can put in 20% of the effort to get 80% of the results, yeah. What does that 20% look like?
Yeah, I would say improve your, have proper hip mobility, have like the Z angle hip mobility, ankle mobility. I would say that solves a lot of issues, especially with running form. If you can improve that, it goes a long way. The belly button cue, that most people have never focused on their rotation. I would work on hip and ankle mobility, the belly button cue when you're running, and then start to activate your foot. Start pressing your big toe down, start doing some toe yoga. I think, and also start doing Bulgarian split squats. Let's do that. Start doing Bulgarian split squats. If you had to do one exercise for the rest of your life, it would be that. Because you can do a calf raise too. You can hold the Bulgarian split squat and just like pump your calf up and down. So big fan of that. So yeah, if we're going to do, what are some 80-20s? Do those five things out of the, I don't know, 20 things, the 40 things we talked about.
Yeah, we might just about scrape under the 20%. I think we might be a little bit over, but I'll give you that. That's all right. I think that's it. So let's finish off with where can listeners learn more? So we mentioned the book. Can you tell us about what is the book called?
Yeah.
Where can they find it? And also what will the name of the new book be, which I didn't know you were writing.
Yeah. So the book currently that's out, it's called Built to Run. It is, you can get it on Amazon, but I highly recommend if you'd like to get a signed copy and we get some swag stuff with us too, some free merch. You get it from us directly. If you're in Europe or in Canada, I would just use Amazon. But if you're in the States, you can get Built to Run. Just type in Built to Run book, or you can go to Alpha Project Physio. That's PHYZIO.com. And there should be a tab where you can get the book directly from us. I sign it, all that stuff. So you can find me on Instagram. It's Matt Silver PT. Also on there, you can kind of find out more about the content that we have. And if you ever want to look more about, you know, what we do and kind of our services, like we do running form assessment virtually all the time, you know, no sales pitch, but if you're interested in anything like that, get in the book, check us out at alphaprojectphysio.com or just Instagram me again, Matt Silver PT. And you know, there's links you can click and everything, but definitely for the book, if you're in Europe or in Canada or anywhere else, Amazon's probably the easiest way. But if you're in the States, it's just easier to ship it for us, where we can we can do a signed copy and some free swag. Highly recommend getting it from us if you can.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Matt. It's been great. And hope to chat to you again another time.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Thanks for having me on.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com, and we will have a bunch of links, of course, to Matt's website, his book, Built to Run, and social media, but also to related episodes. So these are interviews with people like Brad Beer, Matt Pendola, James Debenham, Owen Everard, Max Paquette. These are some interviews that I think are related and were really good and really popular. So check them out. If you're listening on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, you can just go to the episode description in that app, and there will be a list of links for recommended listening below. I always put that for every episode in case you haven't seen that before, so that you can always find something related directly or indirectly that I think you would like to listen to if you enjoyed the episode that you have just been listening to. Just a couple of personal takeaways as well for this episode, because as a coach and as an athlete myself who has had injuries, I want to give my two cents and a bit of perspective on these injury prevention strategies that we discussed, because I know that it can sound overwhelming having so much information and potentially so many things that you quote unquote need to do. But I think that most athletes will need to focus on anywhere from zero to one things, two things at most. Usually, I would say it's one. It might be strength training, it might be mobility, it might be running form. But I've never come across an athlete that needed to do all of these things to be injury-free. I think it tends to be one that is very common. Sometimes it's zero, sometimes it's two. The key thing is identifying your needs, and that is the difficult part, of course. It can take a lot of time of trial and error, and having an expert to help you on the way, like a physical therapist, can really speed up that process. But basically, my main point here is that you don't need to feel that you have to start doing all of these things that we talked about in the interview, or otherwise there's no point, because I would say that if you've had injuries or you're dealing with injuries right now, even, the main thing that you can do is to focus on figuring out one thing that makes things better. And it can actually be a disadvantage if you start doing a bunch of things at the same time, because then if you get better from your injuries that you might be dealing with, you don't actually know what made the difference in the end. Trying out one thing at a time, seeing what sticks, that can be a better strategy, because then you know in the future, if you have a recurrence of the injury, that, well, that's probably a thing that I could do again and that could work. Or better yet, you use that as prevention for future injuries. So it's no different to training, really, in that sense. You could always do more things. There are always more things that you could add to your plate. But what you want to do is to find the training, or in this case, the injury prevention strategy, that gives you the best return on investment. That is just my perspective, but I hope it can be helpful for somebody, and because I really don't want listeners to feel overwhelmed by all of the things that you maybe feel that you have to do, because I don't think that is the case. In the next episode of the podcast, I interview Guido Vromen, who is a Dutch coach and sports medicine physician. He is the coach of, among others, Menno Kolhaas, who has been very successful in races across the Ironman and Ironman 7.3 distances recently. And this will be a discussion on training methods, sports science, metabolic testing, technology, lots more. So it's a really interesting one. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast if you aren't already subscribed, so that you never miss an episode and you always get notified when they are released. And you can, of course, also follow us on social media, because I always post about new episodes on Instagram specifically. I don't think I post anywhere else. That's about it. Finally, a bit of promotion for what we do at Scientific Triathlon. We do coaching, training plans, customized and ready-made. We do consultations, training camps, but the training camps are full for this year, and we'll be back with more, I think, in 2026. But usually the information about that is published around September time, so stay tuned for that. But regarding coaching, if you're not quite on track with where you'd want to be right now, then I would consider coaching as the best option that you can do to get the most out of yourself and reach as close to your potential as possible. You might have tried coaching before and maybe it didn't work out as you had hoped. And I get it. There is a lot of coaching out there that isn't that high quality, but there is also really high quality coaching out there. It might be hard to find, but I think that if that's what you're looking for, you should consider Scientific Triathlon, because that's what we try to offer and what we do offer. You can read more about how it works on our coaching page on scientifictriathlon.com to learn more. And you can email me on michael@scientifictriathlon.com if you have questions, you want to discuss further, or set up a free discovery call for coaching. A big thanks to our sponsors, finally, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high quality, practical, and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS25. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.